Well, if you're not in Genesis 14, I'd ask you to turn there, the preaching text today. It's good to be back at it and good to get back to Genesis and the story of Abraham, or Abram, as we know him to this point in the story. Before Christmas, we had begun looking at the story of the father of the faith, Abram, and God's calling him to follow him to the land that he would show him. And God promises Abraham in chapter 12, remember, two main things, land and a nation. And of course, with that, well, first of all, have to come the promised son, Isaac, from which the nation would flow. But God had told him, go to the land I'll show you, and I'll make you a great nation and bless you, and you'll be a blessing to others. And those who bless you, I will bless, and those who curse you, I will curse. And we begin to see, actually, the practical outworking of that in Abraham's life today in the story. We know that the promises of a nation, ultimately, and people and blessing to the whole world only find ultimate fulfillment in Jesus Christ coming. But we learn some important lessons of faith in Abraham's journey along the way. See, once he reached Canaan, we saw that Abraham, what did he do? Remember back in chapter 12, he worshiped God, he set up altars, he surveyed the land. But then when famine came to the land, he didn't trust God. Instead, he went to Egypt to get help with food, and he lied about Sarah's status as his wife, remember, and eventually got kicked out of Egypt. But God still blessed and restored him, and Abraham grew in faith. Because when he faced a lack of resources in chapter 13 and a need to separate from his nephew Lot, what happened? He gave Lot the first choice. He handled things graciously, and Lot, then we saw, took the fertile area, pitching his tent near Sodom, remember that? And that's where we come to this point in chapter 14. We've seen Abraham facing a lot of barriers to his belief in God. And chapter 14 is a unique text, of course. A lot of difficult names. I should have given Mark a warning about that. My apologies, as there's a lot of tough things in there, but you did great with it, as always. But some seem to think this text is out of place in the context of the story of Abram, his calling, and the covenants God established with him in chapter 15 and 17. But the reality here is what we see is a unique challenge to Abram's faith. War breaks out nearby, and the effects of the sinful choices of Lot are seen. And Abram's response is seen in courage. And most importantly, we see his response after the battle is over, as we'll talk about. As we think about how this applies to today's Christian, there are obviously some important truths about the spiritual battles that we face, and that we have victory in Jesus Christ, and we don't fight a physical battle. Ephesians 6 says that we war not against flesh and blood, but against the principalities of this dark world. That's true. But I think more than that, and more specifically, we see some essential principles about being in the world, as Jesus said, to make an influence, but not being of the world. And that's what we're going to look at today. The reality is, Jesus says to be in the world, but not of the world. And Abraham gives us a great model, as we look at how things happen in this text, of what that's about. We've got a great commission, right? And we're called to take this gospel out, to be involved in the world. But we're not to identify with the world, to become like the world. We've got to be like a doctor who has a cure and wants to take that cure that will heal people, but we can't catch the disease that they have. And so there's a unique balance. That's an ever-growing temptation in the world to be of the world while we're in it. But we can't not be in the world and be involved. And so we're going to see some great truths, I think, in Abraham and in this whole story. Because we've got a purpose as Christians. We can't hide ourselves away in what one man called a holy huddle in our churches, in our homes, away from everything, and make an impact. But we also can't become like the world either. So we learn some things about that, about how we're distinct and different so that the gospel goes forth and that we live the Christian life effectively. And we see that about the balance here. Because the salt, as Jesus said, can't lose its saltiness. But salt has to keep that saltiness, but salt has to be put on the food to do its purpose. which is to flavor it. And we've got to have both of those things if we're going to make an impact and carry out God's will. So what do we learn from this story? Number one thing in verses 1 to 12, as I'll summarize a bit of this, but look at some of the core truths that are there, and that is to discern the results of sin. Discernment is key. To see ahead. That's key to being in the world, not being of the world. See, Lot is not discerning, we're going to see. He wasn't, was he? And the kings from the south in this story who get beat in the battle, they're not very discerning. Those from Sodom and Gomorrah and other nations. But we start with Lot. One man said, Abram settled contently in Hebron, worshiped God in this new built altar. But Lot, who pitched his tents near the Sodom, was now living in Sodom as he pursued prosperity there. Now, essential to living in this world, but not becoming like it, but being able to make an impact while we live in this world, not blending into the world, though, means we have discernment. We grow in that. And that involves growing in a true wisdom that knows and sees things from God's perspective. God's vantage point helps us to navigate then the many dangers that are out there and to see what we're doing now, how it will affect us in the future. And that's what we learn here. That's how we're able, for point number one, to make an influence, to not fall into the ways of the world, but to have a godly influence. You see, if we are constantly being mangled, and there are some Christians that can be like this even, mangled by the effects of sin, continue to fall into trouble relationally, putting out fires in our lives, dealing with the results of our own personal sins, never growing out of those, then we're not going to be very effective, are we, in making an impact. But discernment helps us with that. We're not going to be great in our walk or our witness for the Lord if we're constantly falling in to problems and we don't have discernment. Now, the Bible doesn't tell us that we're going to always avoid the effects of sin and the dangers that are out there. Like you follow some step 1 to 5 procedure and then everything's going to be great. Now, the health and wealth gospel out there, the false gospel, will tell you, you know, just believe that everything will be great. But the Bible doesn't teach that. But the Bible does teach the truth that the godly walk in a growing fear of the Lord, and that helps us to avoid many of the dangers and the effects of sin and what we're doing right now affecting us in the future that the ungodly don't avoid. And we see that in the case of Lot here, how he's entangled in this situation here, and how did he get there? And he feels the firsthand effects of war that comes right upon him and the consequences with Lot. But how did he get there? See, this is not what Lot had counted on when his uncle Abraham in chapter 13 told him to choose which way he'd go. And he went and pitched his tents near Sodom. I'm sure Lot didn't think in any way this is where it was all going to go. Besides, you know, if they'd had some show back then on the top 10 areas to live in Palestine or near there, Sodom might have been on top of the list as far as its luxuries and all the great things that it had, even though it was evil and wicked. And there were ungodly things there, but maybe Lot was thinking, hey, you know, there's these good things. We need to take advantage of it. You know, we can have the best of both worlds. Have our cake and eat it too, you know, and we can benefit from Sodom, and we won't live right in Sodom. We'll just be close to it and get the things we need out of it. Lot thought, well, you know, you can have the best of both worlds and you can still kind of be in the world and of it a little bit and still have faith and walk with God, but take advantage of the things that Sodom has to offer. But what he didn't count on is that when you pitch your tent near Sodom, as he had, it's not long before you find yourself living in Sodom. And that's what we see in verse 12. After the war happens and they take captives, they take Lot, Abram's brother's son, who dwelt. See, now he's dwelling in Sodom. He's living there. To live in the world, to be in it and make an impact, to be not be of it, not be influenced, to be a thermostat, as people say, and make a change, and not be a thermometer that is changed, that takes discernment. When you look at the trajectory of Lot's life in all of Genesis, though, you see that he doesn't learn from this, does he? Because when you go to chapter 19, when God destroys Sodom, guess who's still there? Lot. And he's trying to prevent men from committing homosexual perversion then by offering up his daughters. That's where it all goes. And now Lot, you know, was he thinking back in chapter 13 when he shifted towards Sodom that this would happen? Of course he wasn't, but he did know what Sodom was about. He did know the wickedness that was there and the evil. Someone said Lot should have known when he chose to pitch his tent near there, he could end up living near there or in there. And could he see all of these foul acts that would come in 19? No, but he should have seen the kind of filthiness that was in the city that he was so anxious to live near. The fact is, people don't usually plunge full throttle into a pagan lifestyle, do they? But they don't mind having a little bit of it, keeping their eyes on it, you know? What can I get out of it? Getting a little bit closer to it, but I'm not going to fall into it. I mean, do you ever try to disable an alarm in your house? Maybe the smoke detector, take the batteries out, maybe your alarm clock, so you don't have to hear the warning. And sometimes people try to do that spiritually, don't they? You know, maybe God's warning you that you're getting too close to the fire of sin, of a relationship with someone of the opposite sex, or a habit of stretching the truth or gossip, and you keep kind of toying with it. Because our tendency can be to think that we can be in the world, we're okay, we won't be affected by it, we can listen to what we want to, talk to who we want to, watch what we want to, and it won't affect us, but in time, it does. But wisdom sees it differently, how the world has a powerful pull, so that we'll think about how the effects of what we're doing now will affect us in the future, and others. Because that's what we see here. Lot is in Sodom in chapter 4 when the war comes on him. He's caught in the middle of it. His family is taken off and their goods in the spoils of war. Someone said the reason we've got this is that it impinged, this text, on the life of Abram. Lot's taken captive and he found out this wasn't such a great place to be after all, near Sodom. And sometimes, you know, when Christians backslide, this is what God will do. As we're thinking about worldly things and allow our lives to be affected by it, God may use drastic things to bring us to our senses because He loves us. He'll shatter our peace and the things that we might be trusting in this world so that we don't have our hope in those things anymore and we turn back to Him. And this is what we see. To protect us from the effects of worldliness and trusting in the things of this world, God will many times take us through trials so that we see that our hope is not ultimately in the things that we've looked to and that we thought would make us happy. God will use trials to do that, to point us to Him. But the point is that we learn to think ahead, see ahead, have discernment as we get in His Word about how our choices affect where things are going so that we can actually make an influence, not be influenced, and avoid many times the pain that this sin in this world will most certainly bring. But think about the context in verses 1 to 12 because I haven't really talked about that yet. War breaks out because of international politics and power plays. Four kings from Mesopotamia and Babylon was part of that. They are connected in an alliance led by the king of Elam, Chedorlaomer. You said it better, Marco. Modern day Iran. They joined to fight against the five kings from close to the Dead Sea, around the southeastern side of the Dead Sea. Sodom, Gomorrah, Admah, Zeboah, Beulah. And the point is, there were a lot of city-states at that time that were ruled by little kings, so to speak, and they joined up in alliances to gain control and power and protect themselves. And there was a lot of fertile ground in these where near the Dead Sea where these five countries were, and the kings of the north had control over them, and they didn't want to give up control. And for 12 years, Sodom and Gomorrah and the others lived under their control of the Eastern Alliance. But at year 13, they had enough and they rebelled. And this is why the kings of the East came down to fight, to take charge and not lose what they had. And they didn't come down the normal route, straight through the west. They came and made kind of a zigzag and came down the Transjordan. Why? Strategically to knock out other nations that these five near the Dead Sea could have made alliances with. To knock out any chance of where they might turn to those other nations. They did that first so they'd have greater control. And the point seems to be they overcome the worst opposition of the land that those five might turn to. For example, the giants of the area. The Anakim is one of the ones listed there. They were very, very tall. Big men. And they knocked them out. And someone said, turning northwest, they took the strategic oasis of Kadesh Barnea. It's what the Jews would know that as. Whipping the Amalekites and many of the Amorites. And so that this well-conceived strategy would leave those five kings at their mercy. That's the point. The point spiritually, I think, for us is this. We can never underestimate the power of sin and sinful ways because the world will eat us up. It is literally a dog-eat-dog world. Someone said, why did they bother to come into this area and do all this? Because the south end of the Dead Sea was a main source of copper, the primary metal they used in making agricultural tools and weapons, and Mesopotamia didn't have that, so they were going to hold on to that. And this is the way it is. Some things, they thought, well, you know, Sodom and Gomorrah won't be touched. Everything's going so great. But there's no paradise, one man said, on earth that's free from trouble. Human greed grabs what it can and will use whatever force necessary. And this is what we see here. Moses uses names that the original readers, the Jews, would understand. But he's picturing how this king and his alliance wreak havoc on the whole area. And they reach the valley of Sidon, verse 7. And they turn back and come to En Mishpat, Kadesh. And they attack the Amalekites, the Amorites. And at this point, the five kings from the Dead Sea decided to join the fight. That's the point. See, the Dead Sea is full of salt because partially this is where Sodom and Gomorrah was before God destroyed it. Now it's still there in this story. But they choose to come to the fight finally, and it makes you think, why did these kings of Sodom, Gomorrah, and others wait so long before they actually took the field in battle? Man, they knew what was going on. They knew they owed the king in that alliance tribute, but they waited. And it reminds us, is it possible that the evil and the way that they live in Sodom and Gomorrah caused them to be unalert, reluctant to fight, arrogant, and waiting to the last minute when it was too late? And it was a token defense. They couldn't fight against these forces from Babylonia, and they either had to pay the tribute or they had to figure out a better strategy and take the initiative, but they didn't. And there's a truth here about seeing ahead, about discernment in this world. Are we living with alertness? How prepared are we for what could happen? Are we in God's Word? Are we seeking to know God and to see what He's called us to be? Or are we getting lulled to sleep by the ways of the world? We all have to at times ask ourselves, don't we, as Christians? Are we being prepared? I've said before, the tomato frog in Costa Rica, it's got a defense, it lets out a poison. But the problem is, the poison comes out after it's already eaten the animal. It's too late. How much are we looking ahead? How much are we getting prepared? Are we ready to fight spiritually? No, they wait until so many others have been affected. The enemy has grown in so much strength that it's too late. They had no way they could win. And we see the picture in verses 10 to 12 of these asphalt pits, bitumen pits. There was a lot of salt in that area, and they made asphalt out of that to build and use in structures. And the irony of it is that they fall into their own pits. And these fight warriors, you know, some people think that they were hiding in the pits. I don't believe that. I think more like Calvin, that it seemed to be that in the terribleness of this battle, Calvin says, they are jumping in death into the pits because they'd rather die that way than be killed in the battle. And there we see the effects of sin, don't we? One of God's own lot has affected himself and so many others by not thinking ahead. And that's the first point if we want to live in the world. Secondly, is dedicate what God has given you to do His will. We see in verses 13 to 16. And that's the principle of stepping out in faith and action. Dedicate what God has given you, your resources, everything. How do we live in this world and not be of it? Well, we are discerning. We see that in the negative example of Lot. But secondly, we have to dedicate and step out in faith. And we see that in the example of Abram in his sacrifice and action to help his nephew, but also these other nations. Now, most of us don't think of Abraham as a warrior, as a general. But chapter 14 pictures him like a king of the land God had promised. And there's bravery there, but I'm sure it wasn't without fear. But he's growing in faith. He's trusting God. He's courageous because he's resting in the promises of God. And here, faith is put to work. Faith shows itself in action because faith gets its hands dirty. If you're going to make an impact, faith gets involved. To be in the world is to be here for God's purposes. And Jesus is clear. He came to seek and save the lost. He gives us the great commission to go into all the nations, make disciples. We can't catch the disease of sin. No, we don't want to do that. But we must always remember our main goal is to shine the light of the gospel and live it before people and share it and preach it so that people will come to repentance. And we won't make an impact without that focus. We see it in Abraham's example. 1 Corinthians 5, Paul said, I wrote my letter not to associate with sexual immoral people, but he's not talking about the people in the church. I mean, that's who he's talking about. But he says, not at all meaning the people of this world who are immoral, greedy, swindlers, idolaters. He said, in that case, you have to leave the world. We got to be involved. A fireman must be trained and protected to do his job, but he's still got to go into the fire to save lives. An athlete does all he can to get ready to play, but he's still got to step on the court or the field. It's no different for us. Courage is not the absence of fear, but acting in faith in God in spite of fear. And we see it in Abraham. Christ is our ultimate warrior. He's won the victory, but he calls us to battle. He equips us with spiritual gifts, with prayer, with his word, with fellowship. And we're to utilize all those things that we see in Abraham's example here so that we can make an impact. Dedicating what God's given us to what he's called us to do. We see it here. Someone, one of the kings, somebody from the battle, went about 30 Ks to where Abraham was camped out with an Amorite, which is just another name for a Canaanite, specific name for one of the Canaanites. And he goes to Mamre, the camp there where Abraham is. See, the end of 13 shows us Abraham setting up camp there. Seems he's made friendships, connections, valuable ones with Amorites there. It didn't mean they worshiped together, no. Because he set up altars to the one true God. And it says too here, doesn't it, that Abraham was known as a Hebrew. That's a non-believer called a Jew then, in that time, a wanderer. He was seen as someone who didn't really belong. But get this, Abraham has won them over, hasn't he? They go to battle with him, many of these people. The point is, Abraham was seen as distinct. They come to tell him what happened, and especially what happened to his brother, he calls him, his nephew, Lot. And Abraham makes these connections. We'll look at that. But before any of that, we're reminded of an important truth about our mission in this world. Abram heard his brother. That means he wasn't just looking at Lot as a relative, a nephew, but as a Hebrew who was now taken in war, and he had to do something to get his brother out. James 5 It says, brothers, if any of you wanders from the truth and someone turns him back, let him know that he who turns a sinner from the error of his way will save his soul from death and cover a multitude of sins. I always like the story. I know it's American football. This guy named Roy Riggles, but he was in this American football game, Gridiron, years ago, and he was a center of the California Bears in the Rose Bowl. And he fumbled the ball, you know, dropped it and lost it. And then he went and got that fumble, but he started going the wrong way, running to the other goal. And his coach actually, apparently, I don't know if it's true or not, said, well, let's just see how far he goes. You know, let him go. But thankfully, Benny Lom, one of his teammates, sprung into action, started chasing after Roy Riggles. And apparently Roy went faster because he thought somebody of the other team was chasing him. But Benny Lom tripped him up, tackled him at the 3-yard line, and got him back going the other way. Now, that's Abraham here, in a sense. We see that he escaped, one escape, told Abraham, verse 13, the Hebrew. And we see in verse 14, Abraham heard that his brother was taken. He armed 318 trained servants who were born in his own house. And he went in pursuit as far as Dan, up to the north. Abram could have said, you know, not my monkey, not my show. You know, I got other things to deal with. This is too big of a problem. These nations have their problems. And even with Lot, he's made his bed and he can now lie in it. He needs to learn a lesson from this. But he doesn't, does he? Abraham could have said, you know what? I'm the one God gave the promise to. I'm not going to risk my life. I'm too important. I can't die in this. But that's not Abraham. See, living in the world, we've got to watch out for falling into the world's mindset and methods and traps. If Abraham somehow in resentment didn't go to help Lot because of his bitterness, he would have been lowering himself down to the level of the world, just like everybody else. No, but like the model of Jesus Christ, we see a little model in Abraham. Jesus came from heaven. He didn't sit back. He didn't come because we deserved it. He didn't wait to take the initiative. He came from heaven to save us in the filth of this world. And Abraham is a model. He evaluates the situation, but he acts decisively. He uses his resources. He's shrewd. And he goes into battle. C.S. Lewis said, to love is to be vulnerable. Love anything in your heart will be wrung and possibly broken. He says, the only place outside of heaven where you can be safe from all the dangers of love is hell. See, if we're going to be effective in this world, not becoming of it or like it, those who do that know what God's purposes are. They know why they're in the world. Abraham's desire to save Lot had nothing to do with whether Lot was worthy of it. It had nothing to do with wanting to be like Sodom and really help their evil. No. It was the fact that his brother needed his help. And so did the other nations. It was to do what was right. And I'm convinced many times we will actually fall into worldly ways when we become more like the world because we've lost our sense of mission. Becoming like Christ, reaching people for Christ. And we start to blend in. We think that in isolating ourselves and pulling back, we become less worldly. But we can become more worldly because we're not focused in love and mission. And all the while, we become isolated and become more self-centered, more lazy, uninvolved in what God's calling us to do. We don't become more like Christ and less worthy by isolating ourselves and trying to protect ourselves. We become more worldly that way. We become less Christ-like, less merciful. I'm not saying we become in any way or identify with the world, no, but we can't pull back. We can't isolate ourselves. We have to be involved. Jesus prayed in John 17, Father, I don't ask you to take them out of the world, but to protect them in the world. And Abraham is a picture of getting involved and becoming more and more like Christ, the opposite of the world, not like the world, but sacrificial, loyal, and committed. And he divided his forces, verse 15, against them by night. And they went, he and his servants attacked them and pushed them as far as Hobah, which is the north of Damascus. And he brought back all the goods, and he brought back his brother Lot, and as well as the women and the people. We see Abraham's shrewdness here. Jesus said in Luke 16, the sons of this world are more shrewd in their generation than the sons of light. Jesus said, you're to be as shrewd as a serpent and as innocent as a dove. Abraham is different. He's known as a Hebrew, but he's decisive. He's got these 318 trained men in his house, and there's Amorites that also come along that he's made connections with, and he utilizes that all together and leads them out. The picture is of a sword being drawn out when he steps out. Someone's got to lead, and Abraham leads them out. 318 hired. They weren't hired hands, but they were those born in his house, trained men. They were loyal to him. Sometimes I think we can overlook what God has put right around us that encourages us. People that God has given us in the church or in our family that are Christians that will work with us and give us strength in this world because we're stronger together than we are apart. And there's great strength together. And the enemy loves to divide us. But these men were loyal, trained men in his house that go with him. And then he has other people that go. And the point is, this entourage of powerful kings from the east probably didn't bring everybody down with them in all of this war. They've beat everybody up. They're heading back up the road to home. And little did they ever think that they'd get a surprise attack by a Hebrew named Abraham and his men. But that's what happened. The mighty king, someone said, discover that a few people by faith in the one true God can accomplish wonders. The point is, we can never overlook what God will do through us. Those who look to him in faith, waiting on his timing, getting in his word, seeking to do what his word says and live for his kingdom and live lovingly and selflessly and to reach out and to do what he's called us to do. Never overlook what God will do. And that's why we've got a detailed account here of what these kings from the east do. And then God uses Abraham to take them down in shrewdness and strategy. And this wasn't a surge of adrenaline by Abraham. This is a man trusting God's promises to give him the land. And in a sense, he had home court advantage because God had said, I will give you this land. And Abraham is afraid, I'm sure, but he's going in courage and faith. It's scary at times to serve the Lord, but we remember the one who's made the promises and we're strengthened. And the Lord provided everything Abram needed, even non-believers who helped him go and save Lot and these nations. And God gave him the wisdom to attack at night and to divide up the troops and strategically come at them. And God gives us perseverance. He tells us to never grow weary in doing his good. So they pursue them close to 100 kilometers up to Dan on the road of Damascus in Hobah, probably meaning just right outside of the nation, so that's when they would let them go when they got the goods back. But Abraham made sure that happened. We can never overlook what God does when we're dedicated to him and he uses the weapons he's given us and we use prayer and his word. They seem small, but they're powerful. I always like the story of this lady in Georgia. She called her congressman to complain that her rubbish had not been picked up. And this congressman, Bill Stuckey, was a bit upset that she had bothered him about the rubbish and said, well, why don't you just look up the number of the local sanitation department and call there? And back came the reply of the lady. Well, congressman, quite frankly, I didn't want to go up that high. Now, that was pretty rude. But the point is that sometimes everybody thinks that the power is so much in certain places, but God doesn't look at things that way. He uses us and he uses his word and he uses people that may be unknown to everybody else. But when we're looking to God, this is what he does. What matters is when there are people looking to his word, teaching their children, interceding for the lost, preaching his word, serving those in little ways. And that leads me to point number 3. And that's depend on God for true strength and purpose. And we see it in verses 17 to 20. To seek God's grace. People say, well, don't be so heavenly minded, you'll be no earthly good. And that's baloney. Because the truth is, the more heavenly focused you are in the right way, the more earthly good you're going to be in this world. This is the significance of these two kings that come to Abraham after the battle in the Valley of Sheva, or the King's Valley. Now the fact is, there was great celebration, right? After this victory, people of the word is traveling fast. But, you know, many times on the mountaintops and spiritual highs, that's when we face the greatest battles. We have to watch for that. Pride creeps in, wanting to take the credit ourselves, and greed. And this is the danger, maybe an even more important battle, that Abraham faces now. The kings both come to pay tribute, but their attitudes and agendas are completely at odds. Now, both were Canaanite, Sodom, the king, and Melchizedek. But one views the victory as God's, and the other as something that's been achieved and should be rewarded because it's been achieved by human effort. One plays on Abram's pride, but the other focuses in on the promises and faithfulness of God who brought the victory. And Abram, here's the key, him meeting Melchizedek, the king of Salem, it's like he jumps in and interrupts the king of Sodom. And him meeting him first affects the way he handles the words and temptations that come from the king of Sodom at the end. See, we live effectively in this world, not becoming of it, discerning, seeing ahead, dedicating, stepping out in faith. But the second half of the story is perhaps most important because it's our dependence on his grace, knowing our connection beyond this world, that really empowers us to live faithfully in the world and to make an influence. Hebrews 7, you know, look up the sermon that I did on this years ago on the internet to get more information about Melchizedek there. The one that we read, the passage, it helps you understand who Melchizedek is. He's a type of Christ. He's a pattern, a picture pointing to the ultimate final high priest, Jesus Christ. And the writer of Hebrews, if you look there, will tell you he comes on the scene without genealogy, though I'm sure he had parents. But he's a picture of Jesus. And he's both king and priest. And he, Abraham, through whom the Levitical priesthood would come, gives him a tithe. So he's greater than the Levites. And Melchizedek blesses Abraham. So he's greater in a sense than Abraham. And he pictures the eternal priesthood and perfection of Jesus Christ. And of course that helps us understand the meeting of this king with Abraham. But the focus is not so much on who he is, but on what he does to Abraham and how Abram responds. Now, Melchizedek means my king is righteousness. Salem means peace. And this Salem is more than likely the origin of Jerusalem. He's the king of the holy city, or the beginning of it. But the focus is on the connection here that these two men have together on the one true God. We see in verse 18, Melchizedek brought out bread and wine. He was the priest of the God Most High, and he blessed Abraham and said, "Blessed be Abram of God Most High, possessor or creator of heaven and earth, and blessed be God Most High, who's delivered your enemies into your hand." And he, Abram, gave him a tithe. He was a Canaanite, a priest of the true one true God. He was a Canaanite like the king of Sodom, but the difference was he knew the one true God. He, like Abram, worshipped him. And in this encounter, he refreshes Abram. He expresses goodwill. This was a royal type affair, wine and bread. And he brings gifts and he comes to help Abraham focus on what really matters. God uses him in that. Someone said, his hands were full of gifts, but his lips were full of blessing. And his blessing reminded Abraham of where the victory truly came. His connection wasn't physically as a relative, but with the one true God. They had that connection. And the point is, Melchizedek and Abram are both humble. And Abram shows his response, giving a tithe, yes, to Melchizedek, but ultimately to God. And it shows that his dependence is on the Lord. It shows the value that Abram places on this seemingly small gift of refreshment that came from God. That Abram knows that's what matters the most. His strength comes not from the things of this world, but from the God who gives him the victory. Someone said, many stand before Sodom and Salem, and they face the question, where is my sufficiency? Is it the gifts of Sodom or the bread and wine of Salem? And we face that same question in different ways all of our life as Christians. Do we reaffirm our commitment in the one true God? I saw this post on Facebook. It said, It's hard to buy your husband something for Christmas when he's got everything. He got everything when he married you. Now we have everything we need in Jesus Christ. The one Melchizedek points to, this mysterious king, he points to Jesus. And then finally we close with declare your commitment to Jesus Christ and God's standards. And we see that he speaks up here. He stands out. This is the final principle in this narrative we see about living in the world but not being of it, is to step out and speak out. We see verse 21, the king of Sodom said to Abram, give me the persons, I mean the people, these people that you've rescued from Sodom and the nations, and take the goods for yourself. Now he doesn't bring any gifts for Abram, but he wants to make a business deal. He's thinking in that human mindset, and the contrast is so clear. The king of Salem is pointing out the one true life that Abram has in God and pointing him to thankfulness and rejoicing in what God has done. But the temptation is now that Abram could think that these goods and things are something he had done. And that's why Abram says, I won't take anything from you. In other words, you can give, we'll help these people that help me, that's fine, but I'm not going to take even the smallest thing from you so that you somehow later think that you've done that for me, so that you think that that's where my focus is, or that I won't be drawn into somehow believing that my hope is in the things I've done or the things that I've earned in this world. And Abram makes his declaration. And this would have been tempting because these were some of the greatest luxuries of the world at that time. In Sodom. But he's committed to the Lord. And it's a declaration, someone said, of his allegiance to God and a testimony to the Lord's ability to provide. And he lifts high his declaration. He believes God. He is making a commitment to stand against what this perspective is of this king of Sodom and the ways of the world. And it's a statement of faith. Have we made that commitment to God and Jesus Christ? If you're a Christian, you have ultimately. But maybe we need to renew it. That we stand for Christ. That we want to live for Him. We know everything comes from Him. And there's going to be times where we have to continually renew it. And trust in Him alone. Abram desired to stand, one man said, clearly as a man who prospers only because of God's blessing. Don't we want others in this world to see that in us? That that's what our lives are about. Let's close in prayer today. As we ask for God's grace. Gracious Lord, we come before you today and we ask for your grace and strength, Lord, as we seek to serve you, as we seek to be witnesses for you in this dark world. Help us to be in this world, but not of it. Lord, it's easy sometimes to get blended in, to lose our focus and the mission you've called us to reach people with the gospel and to be salt and light. But strengthen us, Lord. Remind us of the truths that are in this passage, that you're with us. And Lord God, that you're the one who provides everything, and you give us grace, you give us strength and resources to live for your name and to point people to you. Help us to do that, Lord, as we go out as your witnesses. And we pray in Jesus' name. Amen.